Well, let's turn into Daniel chapter 11. So I'm going to read from verse 2 down to verse 35. Must admit, I kind of struggled a bit with this week, mainly because of time, but also because this section that we're up to concerns like lots and lots of different people, and I'm still like not altogether clear in my mind just kind of into what depth to go into this particular section. But so this evening will be, I suppose, kind of a sort of introductory really to this next section, and a kind of sort of overview. And what I'm trying to do is like try to apply it to ourselves today, because especially in a passage like this, as I've pointed out the other week, you know, there's a lot of history here. And what the last thing any of us want, certainly not me, you know, on a Thursday evening when you're tired, is a great long history lesson. You know, that's with no application. What's the point of that? What's the point in just knowing about people who lived, you know, 2,500 years ago, whenever it is, you know? And what we need to know is how the Bible applies to us today. I entitled this series of Bible studies, Living in Babylon, Studies in the Book of Daniel, because I think, spiritually speaking, we're living in Babylon today. And the whole point of this is that we are meant to learn from these things how to live and what to do in our generation, how to see things. And if you're anything like me, you look at what's happening in the world today and it's confusing. Yeah. You know, I said the other week, you know, often Dolores used to say to me when I picked her up on a Thursday evening, first thing she used to say to me was, what's happening? what's going on? You know, I'm like, you know, because something's happened in the news and you think, where does this fit? You know, what is this all about? And I think the point of this passage and other passages in Daniel is that it's supposed to help us to understand something. Not that we can know and understand everything that's going on, but there are certain things that we should understand as Christian people that should make a difference to us. Okay, so I'm gonna start reading again at verse 2 down to verse 35. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength and through his riches he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, not according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others beside these. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years there shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. But from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage, and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfilment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land. with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or before him. After this he shall turn his face to the coastlands, and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honour of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably, and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood there shall be swept away from before him and broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, and they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. But these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them join them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. See, lots of people, lots of events, lots of kings in that passage. And it's difficult as a preacher to know just like to what extent you go into all that. But as I say, this evening, I want to kind of look at the sort of broad sweep of it and see what we can kind of glean from all of that for ourselves. You'll recall in the early chapters of Daniel, we saw how the Lord revealed to Daniel in a number of ways that there would arise a succession of kingdoms, beginning with the kingdom of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. So that was the first kingdom, and then when that kingdom fell, another kingdom would arise, and that would be the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. After the kingdom of Persia fell, it would be taken over by a third kingdom, which would be the kingdom of Greece. And then after that would be a fourth kingdom, more terrible than any that came before it. And what we saw is that fourth kingdom was the Roman Empire. It was the Roman Empire of history. However, in those revelations, it also clearly states that fourth empire would return at the end of time in a kind of revived form. And the person who would rule over that end times kind of revived fourth empire, Roman Empire, would be the person that the Bible refers to by different names, the Antichrist, the Beast, the Son of Perdition, Son of Satan, all these names. It's the Antichrist of the end times. He would appear and he would rule over this revived form of the Roman Empire. And so this succession of kingdoms in chapter 2 is revealed in the form of this kind of great statue that King Nebuchadnezzar saw. And I gave you all a little picture of that to keep in your Bibles. And then in chapter 7, really God is revealing the same thing, but only with a bit more detail, and this time in the form of a succession of hideous beasts that rise up out of the sea. And it's the sea of humanity, you see, and the waves are rising up and down, and out of the sea of humanity come these four beasts. And again, in the fourth one, which is the Roman Empire, there is this latter form of it, where there's 10 horns on a little horn that comes up in between, who is the Antichrist. And so, all these beasts and these kingdoms, they represent what Jesus calls, in Luke chapter 21 and verse 24, the times of the Gentiles. And the times of the Gentiles began when Judah and Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar in, 538 BC or something like that, and will go right through until the time of the Antichrist, well, the time the Antichrist is destroyed by Christ at the second coming. In between that whole period of human history is called the times of the Gentiles. And what chapter 11 in Daniel does is it focuses in on a period within this times of the Gentiles, you see. It's focusing our attention upon a period within that whole at least 2,500 year history. And the time it focuses in chapter 11 is from the fall of Babylon to the Medes and Persians in 539 BC to the time of Antiochus, King Antiochus, who we've come across before in some of our Bible studies, who called himself Epiphanes, which means God with us. In other words, Antiochus the Fourth thought of himself as some kind of God. And he's kind of a sort of prelude to the Antichrist, if you like. He's a foretaste of what the Antichrist will turn out to be. And he reigned from 175 BC to 164 BC, did Antiochus. So in this passage, it takes us from the whole history, from when Babylon fell to Persia, through to Antiochus, and then it takes us from there to the reign of the Antichrist at the end of time. Okay, at the end of the age, I should say. Okay, so currently, in this passage, we're looking at the first part of chapter 11, verses 1 to 35, and this is the period from when power transferred from Babylon to Persia through to Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, so we're not dealing with the end times Antichrist just yet in this passage. That comes from verse 36 onwards. And last week, you'll recall, we were thinking about verses 1 and 2 and the first 4 or 5 of the kings of Persia. And what I tried to show you last week was, if you recall, how those kings of Persia that are mentioned in verse 2 mainly, how they relate to Bible history and which kings of Persia they were and where you can find them in other parts of the Bible, okay? And the point was that the reason these are mentioned and not the other kings of Persia is because of how their life and how their reign impacted upon God's people. That is the point. God's interest is in his people and his kingdom and his plans and his purposes. The rest of human history, in a manner of speaking, is incidental. God's interest is in his people. And so he mentions these particular kings of Persia because of how they impacted on God's people. He cares for you. And he cares for the things that are happening in this world and how they impact your life. God cares about that. You are the apple of his eye, in that sense. The object of his love and his affection. And so we saw, for example, how the fourth of these Persian kings was King Xerxes the First. And King Xerxes the First of Persia is the same king who, in the book of Esther, is called King Ahasuerus. He's the same king. Okay, so King Xerxes the First is Ahasuerus. And you have all read the book of Esther, and probably you love the book of Esther. And you see in the book of Esther how that was a period of time when there was a man called Haman, a wicked man, whose life's ambition was to annihilate the people of God, to rid the world of Jews. it, the final solution, as Hitler called it. That's what he wanted to do in his generation. But God raised up an Esther for such a time as this. And with the godly advice of her uncle Mordecai, and his prayers and her prayers, and the prayers and fasting of God's people, God turned all that on its head, you see, and brought Haman's plans against himself and saved the people of God. You see, King Xerxes in history, for historians, is a great king for all sorts of reasons. But what the Bible remembers him for is how God actually influenced him to do his will rather than the will of a wicked man called him. Can you see what God does? Mm-hmm. And that's the point of this passage. It's to show us how God works in history, you see. And if God works in history, God is also at work today. So that fourth Persian king is Xerxes the First. And what it tells us about Xerxes the First, in this fourth king, in verse 2, is that he was richer than all the other Persian kings before him, and you see that in chapter 1 of Esther, and that by his strength and through his riches, it says in verse 2, he stirred up all against the realm of Greece. And that's exactly what Xerxes the First did. In 480 BC, he put together what historians say was the biggest army that had ever been mustered in human history up to that point. Some estimate it at million, at least a million, but certainly it was hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of men. And he brought them against the king of Greece. But it was a disaster for Xerxes. His venture failed, okay, and he returned, and he never recovered. He never recovered from what he tried to do. And whilst the Persian Empire continued on for, I think, about another 130 or so years or more after, actually another 150 years after his venture against Greece, it never really recovered, and it was a downhill ride from there on, really, you know, after that. But you see, coming to where we're up to in this passage tonight, one of the byproducts of what Xerxes the First did in attacking Greece at that time was that it invoked in the Greek people, and actually lots of other people, a kind of undying hatred for the Persians. They wanted their own back. They hated the Persians after what he did, you see. So, whilst it took another 150 years, 150 years later, Alexander the Great came against Persia, and Persia fell to Alexander the Great. In a colossal way, it fell. And so what you find, and this is the accuracy of Scripture, so what Scripture does here, it says in verse 2, but it goes on, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all, this is Xerxes, by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece, then a mighty king shall arise who will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And that's Alexander the Great. So what God is doing here is going from Xerxes, shooting forward 100 and odd years to Alexander, and missing out all the intervening kings of Persia, because what God is showing is what Xerxes did there actually results in something. Mm-hmm. And Alexander then comes, and the kingdom of Persia falls to him, you see. So the period that we're going to start looking at tonight is the period that begins with Alexander the Great and leads up to Antiochus. I'm not going to even get to him this evening. In fact, I'm not even going to get into this other. So you've got a period here then of 150 years. Okay, from Xerxes to... Are you sticking with this, by the way? So you've got a period here of about 150 years, okay. And most of the details... And I've just read this part of the chapter, and I'm guessing, I'm not suggesting that anybody here is of a kind of low intellect or intelligence or anything, but my guess is that most of the events that I read about in this chapter, you haven't got a clue who they're talking about. When it said the king of the north came to the south and did this and then that, and they married them and they came back and... You know, you haven't got a clue who they're talking to. Well, take heart, Most people haven't either. It's the fact is, that during this 150-year period, most people really don't have a clue about who these kings were, and some of them are queens, or what they did. The events are fairly obscure. They're not obscure to the historian. You can look it all up. It's all there on record. You can look it up. But most of these details are not known to people. And most of it concerns, after Alexander's death, at age 32, his kingdom then was divided up into four, between four of his generals. We've seen this in some of our previous Bible studies. But then most of the details here that are to do with the king of the north. The kingdom of the north was Syria and various other lands to the east, Babylon and further east than that. And the king of the south was the kings over Egypt. They were the Ptolemies. The kings over the north were the Seleucids. And most of the details are to do with the rivalry between those two kingdoms. And the other two divisions of Alexander's kingdom aren't really mentioned at all. So, as I say, most of these people aren't even known by you, or me, or most people. And yet, they're here in the Bible. They're here. They're not named, but you can find out who they are. And probably next week we'll name a few of them. You can find out who they are from the history books. But they're here. The point is, these details are here in the Bible. Yet, it's not popular history. Like maybe a lot of people might look at the life of Henry VIII or somebody like that. It's not popular history. So the first question I ask myself when I come to try and prepare a Bible study like this, and I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, why is this even here? You know, it's a period of 150 years or so. That's fairly odd. Why is it even here? You know, we're not talking here about Jewish kings. We're not talking, you know, we've just been through Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, and we've looked at all the kings of Israel and all the kings of... These are not even Jewish kings. They're not Christians. Christ isn't born at this point in time. They're Gentile kings and rulers who did things that are pretty much hidden. So why are these even here? And then the other question, of course, is why are we even bothering looking at this? And maybe some of you are thinking that yourself. Why are we even bothering? Well, we're bothering because we're looking at this because it's in God's Word. See? Yeah. And it happens to be in the book in the Bible that we're studying. And it's the book of Daniel. And it isn't just because I've got a problem with skipping over chapters. I go away feeling guilty, like, you know, what I've done that for. You know, it's here. So that's why we're looking at it, and that's my first point. You see, I think too many Christians nowadays look at the Bible selectively, yeah, and they decide what they think is relevant and what is not. Do you know what? That is arrogance, in my opinion, and it is a colossal mistake. The fact is, if God chose to put this in His Word for us, then who are we to say, well, I don't think that's relevant to me? That, don't you think that's arrogance? I do. So if I don't understand it, you know, which I don't, well, I'm trying, then it's for me to try and ascertain from the Lord what it is He's wanting to say to me through this. Not to say, I don't think chapter 11 is relevant, let's move swiftly on. By the way, We're coming soon to an end of the book of Daniel, so we're going to be starting another series of Bible studies. And I have a few thoughts in my mind, and I'm seeking the Lord. But if there's something specific you'd like us to look at, let me know within the next couple of weeks or so. I'm not saying I'll definitely do it, but I'll certainly consider it. Okay, if there's a book of the Bible or some subject you'd like us to look at, let you know. Just let me know, and I'll certainly give that. Leviticus is great.
Well, you would
well, anyway, you know, you let me know. I'm not saying I'll definitely do it, but think about that. I'm simply saying it's not for us to say, well, I think this is relevant and that's not God. You know, if it's in God's Word, then we are supposed to find out what the relevance is, and I trust we can find some application here. As to the question, why is this here in the Bible? Well, I suppose there are a number of answers to that question. I mean, one of them, of course, and we've picked up on this a number of times as we've gone through the book of Daniel, and especially when we started on chapter 11, is because of, like, you know, when as I pointed out, when you actually study the history that's dealt with here, and then realise that this was given to Daniel before any of it happened. Mm. And when you look at the historic detail and accuracy, it's just incredible. So it stands as a testimony to God's infinite knowledge and wisdom. It's why I keep saying why liberal biblical Bible critics can't accept that this was written by Daniel in the 6th century BC. Because they know that this is bang on accurate history. And they're saying, well, Daniel can't possibly have known that. Why would he write that? So one reason it's here is to prove that what God says is going to happen in the future. It always happens exactly as God says. That's one thing. But then as I looked at this week, something else struck me about this passage as I looked at it again. And see, when we consider the people and events that are referred to in this passage within this 150-year period, it seems to me that this stands as a sort of snapshot of the entire period that the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles, that we ourselves live in. It's a sort of snapshot, if you like, of what life's like in this world in the times of the Gentiles. It really is. It's all here. And this passage is just like, do you remember when I said last week, if you've watched Dad's Army, you know, there's that, you know, bit that comes on when before the programme starts, and is it Flanagan and Allen are singing, who do you think you are getting, you know, while that's being sang, there's this, like, map of Britain and Europe, and there's these, like, arrows, you know, with Nazi swastikas, and they're kind of pushing forward. And then there's the British flag, and it's pushing down. And sometimes the British flag is gaining ground, and sometimes the Germans are coming back up. Do you know what I mean? Well, this is just like that. It's just like that. You've got the king of the south pushing up against the king of the north, and sometimes he gains ground, and then the king of the north comes back against him and pushes him back, and then it goes the other way, and then somebody else comes in. And it's just like that. It's shifting boundaries, shifting lines the whole time. That's what it's like here. One king arises, and he gains wealth, and he gains power, and he extends his territory, and then somebody else rises up and takes it from him. And then there's an alliance formed of different kings and different, and they go and they fight against the other bloke, and then someone else rises up and takes centre stage, and there's intrigue, there's double crossing each other, there's marriages of convenience that to form alliances between different kings in order to strengthen one another, and there's power and there's greed and there's political shenanigans going on. It's all here, you see, in this passage. And when you look at all that from a distance, like we are, we're looking at it from a distance of over 2,000 years in the future, you know, you can say to yourself, well, what's it all about? What's going on? Some king rules, and he decides he's going to extend his power for whatever reason, and his territory. Maybe he wants to take territory off somebody else because he thinks that that territory will be of strategic importance and value to him, or else it's because he wants to increase his trade with other nations, or it's because he wants to rob other nations of their wealth, or whatever the reason, this king wants to extend his power. And in doing so, he then conscripts thousands upon thousands of men to go and fight in his army and fight his battles for him, and thousands, no, hundreds of thousands die in battle, unknown men, mostly poor people, hundreds of thousands of them die on the battlefield. For what? They leave behind wives without husbands, children without a father, and they die in some foreign battlefield for what? So that the lines on a map can move a bit, only to move back a few years later. You sound like anything. It's First World War, this. You know, where hundreds of thousands of men mowed down and trodden in the mud just so the boundary could move forward 20 foot, while some commander 20 miles back gave the order, you know. And millions died. And you say, what for? Don't get me wrong, I'm not a pacifist, okay? I'd fought in the Second World War against tyranny for my wife and for my children and for the free. I'd have fought. I'm not a pacifist. But I'm talking about when people want to go to war for greed or just to extend the boundaries, and they use the lives of other people just to do that. And you see, that's what we see in this passage. It's just that wars are fought just to change the boundaries on a map, or that some bloke can get richer. And that's what we see in this passage. And can you see, it's like a snapshot of the entire history of the times of the Gentiles. What happened during this 150-year period is just what has happened down through history, and it's exactly what is happening in the world today. Can you see? You know, you look at it, as I said the other week, and you say, what's happening? Is there really any reason in it? Is there any reason in it? Is it bringing forth anything, all of this? Well, I guess there are two views on that, really. I'm talking about all the wars, and all the strife, and all the fighting, and all the killing, and everything else. Is there any reason in any of it? There are possibly two views on that. Either one believes there's some kind of master plan for the world, alright, whatever one believes the master plan is, or else there's no plan at all, no reason. Everything just happens by chance, and everything will continue to happen by chance, just as it always has. Unless, by chance, we destroy ourselves, or by happen chance, some global disaster happens and we all get destroyed by an asteroid or something that hits the Earth or whatever. So, there's either a master plan, or else everything's just pure chance. Well, which do you believe? Actually, there's another question. Which is more scary? I'll tell you what I think's more scary. Everything's by chance. That's more scary. Because if there's no plan, if there's nobody in control, if everything is just pure happen chance, then how do you know you're even going to be here tomorrow? I think there's a plan. I think there's a master plan. I believe God has a plan. And by saying that, I'm not saying that God is the author of war and the death and everything like that. Those things happen by the will of man. But God has a plan. God has a master plan. As a matter of fact, I believe there are two master plans that are currently in play. And they sort of overlap and they interact with each other and against each other. One is God's master plan for the ages, and the other is Satan's. Okay? And they both have a desired end in view, you see. Now, I know that God's master plan and the end that he has in view will happen. I know that. But I also know that Satan has a plan, and that he has been beavering away in the background working on his at the same time. God's plan is to bring in the kingdom of his son, and it's all for God's glory. Satan's plan is to put his man on the throne and establish his kingdom in the earth under the rule and authority of the man that he puts in place. That's Satan's plan. And both these plans are in play at this point in time. Okay? So, just as we see in the events of these this 150-year period of history, which, to the uninformed mind, appears to be a series of events with no rhyme and reason behind them whatsoever. Yet, ultimately, all the things that happen in verses 2 to verse 20 pave the way and set the stage for the coming of this person, Antiochus Epiphanes, who in this scripture, in verse 21, is called a vile person who initially comes in peaceably. He seizes the kingdom by intrigue. He acts deceitfully. He persecutes God's people. And he sets up in the temple something called the Abomination of Desolation, which he is a statue of Zeus, as a matter of fact. He has a pig sacrificed on the altar of God. He sets up a statue of Zeus, and basically he's claiming he is God and to be worshipped. Okay, but everything is leading up to that, paving the way, setting the stage, as it were, setting the scene for him. And he's a forerunner of the Antichrist, you see. So it is with the events of the history of the times of the Gentiles, even up to this present time. There are all these things are working together to set the world stage for the coming of the Antichrist and the establishing of his global empire. That's what's happening today. If you see it, if you see your news and you wonder what on earth's going on, that's what's going on. That doesn't mean to say that everybody in politics is evil and they're all working together with this great satanic conspiracy. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that Satan is working world events in an effort to bring in his person over the empire that he is setting up. So, the rise and fall of empires. Go back as far as you like. You know, Napoleon, whoever came after him, you know, and all the rest of it. And World War I, World War II, you know, all these other conflicts that have happened since. What's happening in the world politically? The shifting of political alliances and power blocks. All of that is slowly moving, shifting the chess pieces, as it were, shifting the pieces of the jigsaw, putting them all together to set the world stage for the coming of the Antichrist. Okay? All the different... You know, if you look at maps today, get a current map and compare it with a map from 40 years ago, 30 years ago, you'll see the lines are drawn in different places than they were even a short time ago. Well, all the lines of the map are changing, and they'll continue to change until the coming of this Antichrist. It's all bringing something forth. What is it? It's the kingdom of the beast. Okay, but somebody might say, well, if that is so, if all these things are going to bring in the kingdom of the beast, does that then mean, you've just told us, Ian, that there are two master plans currently in play, God's and Satan's. And it's Satan's desire to bring in the Antichrist and to set up his kingdom. So if the kingdom of the beast, if the kingdom of the Antichrist comes, if that's what's happening, does that mean that God's plan has failed? No. Not at all. No way. God will allow the Antichrist to rise to power. You know, he's going to do great evil in the world. The greatest persecution that history has ever known will come under his rule. So somebody might say, well, why don't somebody get out there and shoot him? It's an interesting question. You know, you look at what Hitler did in the 30s and 40s. And you said, do you not sometimes think to yourself, could somebody not have got him?
Yeah.
Like before he managed to kill all those Jews. And, you know, could somebody not have shot him in 1941 or something like that? How come he lasted as long as he did? God will remove restraint and he'll allow this Antichrist person to come in, to take power, to exalt himself, to persecute the saints, to set himself up in the temple of God. It says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, set himself up in the temple claiming that he is God. Revelation 13, having the world worship him. God's going to remove restraint and God's going to allow that for a short time. But only for a short time. And then when that time comes to an end, the master strategist, God himself, will send his son, who will come with power and great glory, and the Antichrist will be destroyed, the false prophet will be destroyed, and all Gentile power and all Gentile rule will be brought to an end forever and ever. That's what the book of Daniel is really all about. So, that's what this is about. And the point is, it seems to me, when you look at this 150-year period, that's a snapshot of our world today, of the whole of the period of the Gentiles, then what you see, if you look at it with uninformed eyes, everything looks meaningless. Everything looks happenchance. But the child of God is supposed to understand that actually the master strategist, God himself, is at work behind the scenes, and what looks bad, in the end, he will work it all, he'll bring it all together to bring his own plans to pass. That's for our encouragement for us. And that's why we shouldn't ignore chapters like this. That's why we're idiots if we say it's not relevant to me. Because it is relevant. Because if you don't get it, then you go the way that the rest go, and that is, well, we've all got to do what we can to kind of make the world, you know, to try and look, because everything's chance. Yeah. So very quickly, before we finish, let's just go to verses 3 and 4, where it says this. It says, so then, when he is risen, his kingdom shall be brought... Oh, sorry, verse 3. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. So, as I say, this mighty king, it means hero king, is Alexander the Great. Now, we don't need to spend a lot of time with Alexander here, because in previous Bible studies, we've already done that. He's come up before in the book of Daniel, especially in chapter 8, but in chapter 7 also, Alexander the Great has come up. And it's interesting that he's called Alexander the Great, even to this present day. And the words in the Hebrew, in the language it was written in, mean hero king, and he still is. He's still regarded as a hero king. He's still regarded as one of the greatest men who ever lived. You remember Alexander became king when he was just 20, and he died when he was 32. And in the intervening years, he only started to conquer at age 22. So in 10 or 11 years, he basically conquered everywhere from North Africa right across to India. And he did it with such lightning speed, velocity, you know, the world didn't know what it hit. I mean, this was a military genius. And it says he will rule with a great dominion, and that's what he did. He was like a sole ruler. What Alexander said is what actually went. He was a powerful, powerful ruler. I just want to pick up on what it says there. It says, and he will do according to his will. This is Alexander. But I think that speaks of man generally in sin. He does according to his will. See, I've just spent most of this Bible study trying to say that God is the God. It's God who has a master plan. He's the master strategist. And in the end, God's will be done. The trouble with man is, he's blind. He's blind to that fact. And man likes to be the master of his own destiny. He wants to be in charge of his own will. And he thinks he can forge out his own future and his own destiny. Alexander certainly thought that. And if ever a man could have, he could have. Mm. But he died at 32. And what happened to his kingdom? It didn't even get left to his posterity. It didn't go to his son. Mm. It went to his four generals. His four generals were Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy and Seleucus. It went to his four generals after a bit of a struggle, a bit of a fight. That's who it went to. So he didn't even get to leave what he'd made to the persons of his choice. And I thought to myself, isn't that just like the way it goes? These people in the world today who are people's heroes, the people who the world regards as great, and sometimes they die young. In the rock world, you know, there's something called the 27 Club. And the reason for the 27 Club is some genius rock musicians and singers all died at 27. Isn't that spooky? Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and all of others. And others, still quite young, died young. And I'm talking about people who the world would still idolise and still say that person was the one. Elvis died young. What was he, about 47 or something like that? Oh, 42, I think. John Lennon, he was about 40. You know, the list goes on. You know, and these are people who are still the idols. People who made absolute millions in the day and then gone. Yeah. Who did what they willed, just like Alexander, but then gone. And the problem is, some Christians want to bring that into the Christian life and still do as they will. But you know, when we become a Christian, we should surrender our will to God's. God knows best. Okay? So when Alexander died, his kingdom then was divided up to these four men. Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And they ruled over each a part of that kingdom. And that kingdom was never as great as it was under Alexander. It never was ever again. But this passage, we're going to close this here at this point, but this passage then, where we're going to pick it up next week, just deals with two parts. And that is the kingdom of the south and the kingdom of the north. The kingdom of the south is Egypt. The kingdom of the north is Syria. The kingdom of the south was ruled over by the Ptolemies. The kingdom of the north was ruled over by the Seleucids, and they are going to struggle against each other for who has rule over the Holy Land. And again, you see, that is the point of this. It's all about how the world of the Gentiles affects God's people. Well, God loves you. God cares for you, and God has his eye on you. I was going to say, you know, just finally in closing, where are the people of God in this whole passage? Until you get to Antiochus, they scarcely mentioned at all. And I thought to myself, as I was trying to prepare this Bible study this week, well, isn't that just how the world views, certainly historians, how the world views Christians? They don't become part of the story, really. Christianity is seen as an irrelevance. Pretty irrelevant, really. Hardly mentioned. That's how the world looks at it. Where are the people of God in that? Well, they're there, behind the scenes, and God has his eye on them. He knows everything else that's going on, but his eye is on his people. And he knows what's happening in the world today. And his eye is on his people, and on his kingdom that he's bringing in. Amen.